Well, hello, everyone. It is Monday, the 6th? Yeah, wow, the 6th of July, 2020, and this is Wes Fryer here in Oklahoma City, and I'm being joined by Brian Turnbaugh again up in Chicagoland, and we're going to continue brainstorming this this project, which I continue to be very energized by, and part of the reason why I wanted to do these things, like, it's been a month since we got together and talked, and
it doesn't seem possible.
Imagine. Yeah. So, so I'm at the Cassidy School here in Oklahoma City. Actually, I'll be teaching some Spanish next year.
Wow.
Because of the pandemic. We, anyway, need a Spanish teacher to pick up a couple sections, but I teach mainly media and digital literacy to 5th and 6th grade. I'll be teaching an introductory Spanish semester for some 5th graders, which I think I can pull off, I think. Continuing to, you know, coach our teachers and work with them. So Brian, what's your by day, you know, media literacy, podcast maven of the Enlightenment. By night, by day, Cubs fan.
Yeah, trying to find all those. Yeah, well, no, more Bears fan. You know,
oh, it's Bears.
Broken heart so much, yeah. But yeah, Cubs fan for a time. So the so you can see the proper C right there. Yeah, so I teach AP language and composition. I've every year except this year, I would have taught some type of interdisciplinary class, which is a it's a team taught idea where I will pair up with a social studies teacher. For about 14 years, I taught global studies with my partner, Dave Sainer, who was just retired this year. And that was freshman geography paired with freshman English. Taught 14 years that. I've taught 3 or 4 years with at the junior level, which is blending American history and the American literature. And then I taught 1 year, which was world history, so I've been kind of the, the fix it guy in English to go in any of those places. So, but I love that's interdisciplinary is probably the reason why I am able to seek out really good supplemental texts for actual literature and has created so much more of a rich research for everything that I do in my classes as an English teacher. It has been as a result of the underpinning kind of educational philosophy of it, interdisciplinary. It's the best. And then I've taught for many years. I developed the media literacy class at the high school. I haven't taught that since I've started AP language, but that's been in good hands, with, teachers at the school. So, but that's, I mean, that's, it's always my default, curiosity as a teacher to see, especially everything that we've been talking about, Wes, is, what I think that we have seen is, we're slipping with our understanding of what, how to just know what truth is. And if we can't stand on firm ground there, we're in really big trouble. And I think that's what, how do we begin to, have some traction with our students so they can be, have a keen eye to be able to develop the critical thinking skills and know what the type of texts are that are worthy of engaging with, learning from, and ones that are just outright dismissible right from the get-go. And I think that's that initial kind of parting of the path, I think, is what we, especially at the age level, I think that we're thinking about with this project is key. And I the more they think about it, you know, something as easy as the moon landing and looking at some of those things, there's really, I mean, anyone can be mad about anything, but I mean, at least that's not one that I think is going to catch only for the most rabid of conspiracy families, I think would be angry about that one, but I'll be glad to catch that, you know, to go after that one if we have to kind of cross with that.
Well, safely being able to talk about these things, we need to be able to engage in relevant conversation about not only historical issues, but the issues of the day, but not just in recent times, but for a while in our polarized society, there have been a lot of things that are very difficult to talk about, even, you know, some current events. And so I think we want to find ways that we'll be able to do that in constructive ways to help equip kids for critical thinking. And it really is about citizenship. It's about representative government. I mean, the stakes are high for this. So I put this, I guess I can't share to my personal page on Facebook with this StreamYard, but We've got some different people viewing. Medialiteracy.westfire.com. I've just kind of started to aggregate some different resources there. In fact, the Institute of Digital Literacy for the last 2 years has had a monthly book club, and I met again today. Man, it's just such a great tribe. That link and some others are here. And I just started to use a hashtag, ConCW. Hey, there's Kristen. Hey, I wonder if she's in Chicagoland today. Chicago is where the Institute was supposed to be face to face this year. But now it's gone online. So anyway, hashtag, if you're interested in sharing resources, I've been for a while, you know, Twitter has become one of my places where I want to put information that I can get later. And my friend Jason Neifert has talked in some sessions about like it's like a bear trapping metaphor, but like we all need to be trappers of information and you need a trusted place where you can put stuff and find it later. So anyway, finding a hashtag that nobody's using, of course it could be hijacked at any time by anybody who would want to, but to kind of summarize the project, I mean, we'd had another one of these discussions, that is available on YouTube and in a podcast. And this all came from last summer when Brian and I, myself for the first time, it was your second year, right? Or was it your third last year?
Yes, yeah. It was my second year.
And this is my second year to come back to the Institute. We're at the Institute for Digital Literacy and have just been exchanging a whole variety of links and resources that, it's sort of like the opposite of being radicalized. Cause you think about being radicalized, you think of somebody, listening to disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, and then really going down a negative rabbit hole of falsehood and harmful, you know, information and perhaps action. Kind of in the opposite, and we might think of enlightenment, you know, I kind of think that, you know, Brian has opened my eyes through a number of media recommendations, podcasts, some books, tweets and posts that people have shared, that really has deepened my own understanding of connecting dots when it comes to lots of the issues we're talking about, specifically conspiracy theory and the ways that that has become so mainstream. And in the case of the moon landing and talking about that, I mean, that there's so much via, especially YouTube, that not just kids, but people of any age can have access to, the ways in which the platforms have really pushed people to fringe content. And, you know, and as you said, Brian, some of the bigger questions, it's about truth. It's about, at the end of last session, the last talk, you know, this idea of being a skeptic without being a nihilist, or if we wanted to say that, I mean, being a skeptic is a positive way, but sort of maintaining idealism, right? We need to maintain hope and we need to, you know, maintain hopefully our passion for civic engagement and for helping, shape our institutions and contribute. I just listened to a Humane Technology podcast with Tristan Harris and, the interview, one of the things that he said is, I mean, how do we help ensure that that elections are won through democratic processes and not through disinformation? They were talking about how our brains psychologically can probably only remember two or three things about a candidate. And if this is, I guess, what's happened in Brazil with Bolsonaro is that with disinformation, he's a very fringe candidate, but he's able to discredit with lies, opponents. And, you know, then there's this really fringe guy who's advocating burning swaths of the rainforest. And I mean, at what point is something an existential threat? And we're all familiar with the, you know, Chicken Little and the sky is falling and there's all kinds of headlines around security and hacks and things like that. And we're probably desensitized to it to a degree. But I think part of what I want to do is help awaken more people in a very positive way to what I do perceive to be an existential threat to representative government. And I apologize that Wes did not click do not disturb on his computer. So sorry about that. So anyway, we kind of left last week or, you know, last week, 4 weeks ago, talking about how if we were able to share something at the Institute for Digital Literacy, it might be around a workshop and some real specific resources and lessons, things that teachers could dig into, you know, in that time and then practically, you know, sort of like a make and take, but like, here, we've done some of this. Now go back and talk to your students about that. So what kinds of thinking have you done since we last talked about that? And you, I think, probably participated. I have missed the Zoom calls that they've had for the Institute. So where's your thinking gone in the last couple months with all this?
Yeah. So, one of the things that, I wonder about, I was thinking about the concept of the rabbit hole. And we'd have to figure out what would be the easiest way to do it from a technology standpoint. But I had done something with this with my, when I was going after the digital literacy certificate through University of Rhode Island, one of the projects that we evaluated different kind of research approaches when you have to go online. So it was basically, I made these videos of a screen capture of me going to search various topics through YouTube or through Google or through Twitter and then maybe even something that was like a legit ABC Clio, like a database or something like that. And what I did was I wanted to demonstrate something similar to what we were doing, which was let's just take something like global warming, or let's take something like, you know, and let's see where the search takes us. So, you know, part of what we could do would be, what if we did something similar to that, which was that, I haven't quite exactly played out the logistics of how this would be like a choose your own adventure, but what if we said, what if we had like a web page and we had a video, and the video started off with, okay, so you want to research the moon landing. Let's go to Google. So we search Google, and then now the video of the screen capture only has the first, let's say, page of moon landing hits or something like that. And then we do a freeze frame, and then we maybe highlight the screen and say, which link should we look at first? Right. And so we could almost say like, and then the next thing could be a link that could take you to the next choose your own adventure and say, now look what happens because you clicked here. And then we could simulate the type of rabbit hole that you go down, unfortunately, when you don't choose properly, and then do a type of commentary, with that. The Google will be interesting, but I think what will be really eye-opening is when you take it to the swamp of the algorithm of YouTube, because then really it can be really, really rough. And I think then you start with, okay, I'm going to search moon landing, and then see what are the first five hits that come back. And then what we could look at is, there's going to be one, I'm sure, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, is that we'll find one that is a moon landing that will be from National Geographic. Okay, well, why would we think that this would be a better source rather than, and then insert, you know, some other production company that you've never heard of or whatever, or if it even is a production company, if it's just a vlog style thing that we have where someone's pontificating with, with no sourced ideas, you know, that could be its own kind of choose your own adventure. And each step of the way, does this add up to good scholarship and good journalism, good research? And so I'm just kind of thinking like that could be, it's a little bit more work on the teacher to set that up, but the simulation of it. And then, to be honest, it could be something that the students could create in their own workshop as
well. Here's a big thing. The results are different, right? I was thinking maybe we could recommend the creation of a new account, because, and then you and I could also, we get to train the algorithm, and people talk about, oh, I'm gonna delete all my Google stuff and all this. I mean, I actually love the fact that things that I'm into, I've been doing lots of reading about like quantum mechanics and like dark matter and, you know, exoplanets and things like that. And the way in which it can be very positively used to find things, or artificial intelligence. I mean, and some of it's stuff that touches on these issues, but, you know, Google, the algorithm is incredibly powerful. One of the things that I think is a specific, we want to help people have their light come on, is like, your search results weren't the same as my search results.
Right.
And so I think, you know, that I love that idea where we could have some things done in searches, but then students could go do them on their own. And we potentially could create an account that we have, like, basically started to go down a rabbit hole with that account.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and what are the signals that we do on YouTube? Certainly just the things we watch and how many minutes and hours have been watched of particular videos, but liking videos, subscribing to channels and commenting, those are all signals that we, you know, are basically programming back into the engine. And then that's telling us the things that we like. So I think it would be fascinating to take a look at sort of like without any prior massaging, you do a search on your account for moon landing hoax. What do you get? What do I get? We can take a clean account, so to speak, like one that hasn't visited YouTube. I can, you know, work with our technology department as far as like, you know, creating a temporary, you know, Google account that we could use for that. But anyway, that's something that strikes me because
Wes, even the difference between the suggestion of once you start typing in moon land and then see what the autofill is, that's the other part too. That's so, I don't know how you would necessarily teach this, but I mean, I always remember this was years ago when I would type into a Google search, global warming or something like that, or climate change. And what you see is out of the 8 suggestions, 4 or 5 of them have something that suggests lie, hoax, you even click on wanting to have that information. So the type of gaming of the algorithm by bad actors to create the type of outcome that you want is, I guess that's the other part that would be tricky to deliver to that's where, I mean, it's part of the game, right? So maybe part of it is understanding, you know, if we're going to get all kind of Marshall McLuhan, you know, on this, which is understanding the medium by which we get this information, right? So the medium is the message and the medium is Google, which is an advertising information. An advertising platform that delivers you information.
Yeah.
So everything that you put in there is a way by which it is going to glean information that will then theoretically deliver you to a consumer decision that you'll have to make at some point, either explicitly with the, you know, what shows up in the cookies or whatever, they'll resell that information about you to some other vendor. But that's the principal reason why we have that Google exists, that we get information that we want is a close second for what we have. So, but there's always that first part of that. So I don't know how we make that
screencast
crisp to a 5th grader, 6th grader, where that matters. But it's the idea that just know your role in this exchange when you're on the medium. I think that's got to be part of the conversation.
That's a huge piece of what we can try to do. Kristen Hokanson, who is in Pennsylvania, not Chicago, is asking in the chat if we're steering away from controversial issues. No, we're not. But I think what we want to try to dive into, we want to dive into these in such a way that we don't get fired, which that's probably an extreme statement, but you know, there definitely is pressure on teachers when you talk about political issues. I mean, people are so hypersensitized to things that if we, for instance, directly like tried to teach for this plandemic and disinformation by our chief executive today in the United States, that is probably going to just lead to some pushback and some just direct parent as well as student, like, what are you doing talking about that? And so I think there's a gentleman, and he's in our resources, John Cook, who does a lot of he's written books and work on conspiracy, particularly with respect to climate change. And why is it that there's all these folks that just seem to reject scientific consensus, and what are the characteristics of conspiracy theory? And then what are the strategies? Cause this really is from like a propaganda hack your brain kind of thing. Like, cause you can look at that Plandemic documentary and other things and be like, yep, they're using the conspiracy playbook. So the idea part of this is to try and help students and parents. I mean, we want to educate the community, not just kids, but kids specifically, become aware of why do some people find conspiracy theory to be attractive? What is the playbook for that? And I think the discussion about moon landing, I had mentioned, you know, this was an aha with our daughter who's now 16. And this was, you know, the last year or so, I just realized, I mean, she's heard more about the moon landing being fake than any of our children and her generation is being exposed to that. And so I definitely think uncovering parts of the algorithm, the part that we play, I love that because I totally think this needs to be something interactive. And to your point about the autofill, screencasting is phenomenal as an assessment tool. And so that's one of the things I taught my kids first last year in our media and digital literacy classes. We actually did it with Minecraft, which of course is highly, you know, motivational, but I was like, you know, 60 seconds or less, they had to give me this tour, but they learn how to screencast so they could screencast, you know, just on their account before they've programmed it. Cause I don't even know how many of our kids realize they've sort of programmed their own YouTube recommendations, right? By the things they've watched and the things they've liked. I'm careful when I switch channels. Like I've got that Wednesday night EdTech Situation Room and sometimes I'll watch videos and I'm all the time liking stuff, subscribing because I am trying to teach YouTube, hey man, I like this. And so sometimes I'll find myself, oh man, shoot, I forgot to change that channel. And we don't use it that much, my friend Jason and I, but it's jarring to not jarring, but it's like, I notice it when I log in there to the channel because I was like, whoa, what's that recommendation? Oh, because Jason does it sometimes too. He loves bread and he's like into cooking, you know, sourdough bread or whatever. And I'm like, what am I doing seeing that? Well, it's because he was logged into that channel and he liked that stuff. So I don't know. I see that as a great specific thing that we could create some activities around. The thing about autocomplete is really big because this is part of how YouTube and Google will basically push us towards extreme content or content that we will find that people just tend to find more engaging. But it also, you know, in many cases tends to be further from the truth. And that's what makes it an outlier. And that's part of what I think we want people to become aware of.
The algorithm is, you know, it is fascinating. I remember I was listening to an interview on the Farnham Street podcast a year or so ago. And I don't remember exactly who the guest was, but they were talking about, you know, how the algorithm could also be seen as like this very weird mirror into what collectively we look at. And I think, you know, this was so sad. I mean, you could probably still do this, but if you went into the search of YouTube, sorry, Google, and you typed in, how can I learn to, and then you see what drops down. Some of them might be, you know, code, you know, whatever language, how to kind of learn Spanish. But then one of the other ones that was so heartbreaking was one of the drop down was, how can I learn to love myself? Right? Like, and that someone would like, that there's enough of people out there that have that level of anxiety that are looking for a type of answer into Google as well. So I think that speaks to another part of why technology is so powerful, is that people trust it, that they would put up such a intimate secret like that. And if they're willing to do that, then they're going to be very ready to have an answer that feels right. And I think that's also part of the reason why sometimes confusion of people that are a certain sensitive place in their life where an answer that provides a sense of trust and community and in some ways empowerment, which oftentimes those things happen within conspiracy theory thinking, I think is so problematic.
So I'm jotting down, we've got this Google Doc going, and if you want to link to it, whether you're listening live right now or you check this out later, I've got it linked from this medialiteracy.westfire.com. There's a link at the top to this CONCW hashtag. So I'm putting in some notes, and I put down for web literacy skills, helping students understand that we each teach the algorithm. I love that idea that we could suggest some autofill strings, because this is a dynamic thing too, right? I mean, we're going to create this activity here in July of 2020. And by the time people do it in September or October, like, YouTube's algorithm is going to change. Those results of, you know, learning, and they're going to be customized by the user and what they've done. It also would be interesting, like, education accounts are supposed to be different in Google Apps, and I genuinely think they are as far as the monetization of data. But it will be interesting, and this could be something too, where teachers do things like, if I do the same search on my consumer Gmail, is that different when I'm doing that on my school, you know, Google account and student account? So I wrote that down as a thing to become aware of, that we're teaching the algorithm. I also think that we want to help people have a specific web literacy strategy. And last year at the Institute for Digital Literacy, Dave Quinn did a great session talking about SIFT, which is Mike Holden's strategy for, you know, step one is stop. I mean, being aware of emotional content, lateral reading, not just going on one particular site. So, because part of what I think we need to help reset with teachers, if we can be so audacious to want to do this, like, there's advice that we've given kids for a long time, like, oh, is it a .org site or a .gov site? Oh, must be credible. You know, oh, visit the about page. Does it look like it's professionally made? Oh, okay. You know, that advice is totally not doable. But what you said about the autofill reminds me, like, Alan November, sort of back in the day, you know, in the mid probably 90s and late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, he was really big into Alta Vista searches, but in, like, keynotes and presentations, he would encourage teachers to use the web. And it was about really, it was probably that McLuhan thing of understanding the medium. You know, how does the search engine work? How can you make the tool work for you? And so I think the idea of giving teachers and students some specific things that they can do on their account, ways that they could capture those, maybe compare them to results that we've had, and then even through social media, and that might be through the teacher accounts, but being able to share some of those things, and that's a challenge and puzzle as far as the age of the kids and all that kind of stuff. But
I think what also plays into it with some nudging could be the gamification, because this is a type of hunt, right? Which is like, okay, what's a red light? Like, you do not go there. And to be able to turn it over where we have given them the type of skill to identify and say, whoa, let's see. Then what's the green light? And then what's the yellow light? So it might be that you have to kind of work the polar ends of that, which is, okay, this is a no-go because I can't find X, Y, and Z off of just what appears to be the very the front of this YouTube video, or even within the first 20 seconds, whatever might be the kind of tells of that. But then again, then what would be the good, you know, like, okay, well, we should proceed. Because I really think that, you know, if students, as much as it's not that we want to keep them away from YouTube, but, you know, there's a reason why we have paid, many of our schools have had our librarians secure databases, because these are vetted materials from scholars and journalists, and they've done this, but we know students, they're creatures of habit. They want to hop and get things very quickly done and just be as expedient as possible. So short of saying never give me YouTube, you know, as a source, but if they do venture there, now this must be entrenched in their mind. It's almost like, you know, how would you want to be equipped going into, to go buy a car or some kind of transaction where, the consequences are you paying more for something that you didn't have to pay more for, if it's financial, or for something that could be very important, like your health or some type of civic surrender that you've given up because of what you've seen. So I think it, like, the more that we can kind of find those types of parallels in the transaction of that what happens, you know, when you move away from, you know, what that is. And I think, unfortunately, maybe the refs have been worked so much that, you know, people are looking for bias everywhere. It's not that bias is necessarily a bad thing. If that then be, it's just that you can identify what that is and know what it is. But when you're talking about bad faith drivel that comes from the conspiracy theories, and all of that, you know, how can we give the tools of at least giving a base understanding that this scholar, this production company, this director, this writer, that they have some type of standard based in how they've decided to go about making this for you to consume as an information piece. And that if they have messed up, that they will correct it, and that there are ways versus some of these other things, like there's no contact number. There's no ombudsman that's going to, kind of hear out the complaints. Right. And so, those might be some other things that we look, you know, that could be like, you know, does this place have a way to, have they ever corrected anything that they've ever done? Or is there a way in which that they would be, accountable for such misinformation if that is something that's important to you?
What is journalism? You know, what qualifies as a journalistic source? And what do we call these other sources? Because, and it's not all the Russians, right? But it is Russians too, you know, and other groups who are creating these groups and building these followings. In the chat, Kristen is asking, how do you get the kids to do that for themselves? That is exactly right. I'm reminded of conversations that I've had in the past about digital, you know, storytelling and just media creation and the ways, I think maybe this was Marco Torres, but like if you really help students critically consume and watch media, like, sometimes kids would come back and say, you've almost ruined media for me because I'm always watching for things. But like,
that's not ruining. That's empowering. You know, that's the way you got to reframe.
Yeah, I mean, some kids would say it that way, but like, you know, George Lucas is going to only use certain kinds of transitions, and wipes and things like that, you know, PowerPoint and iMovie and these tools, they'll give you all these things, but what is Martin Scorsese, if I say his name right, I think I blew it. What are different directors, you know, how do they choose to tell stories? What are the means that they employ? I think that's part of what we want to do too. It's a separation with content and strategies, right? And so there are playbooks and ways in which we can separate, like, okay, fine, that's a message that they're doing, but let's look at how it's communicated and let's try to analyze the source and where it's coming from. You know, that lateral reading comes in. I'll put this into the chat. The website infodemic.blog is Mike Caulfield's, specifically COVID-19 focused, you know, SIFT and media literacy, web literacy website. I think Wikipedia, and he talks about Wikipedia and talk pages, right? If we're trying to figure out, you know, is this a source that is credible that I'm going to believe? Wikipedia has dealt with these issues since time immemorial. And I've used this strategy even like on Facebook when somebody has shared something, I'll go to that talk page. I'll get some information because, I mean, the controversies are being hashed out and debated. It's another thing I would love to help reset is just there's a lot of, I think sometimes as human beings, we want to paint with a broad brush. And so we want to say, and so educators can sometimes do things like, oh, well, Wikipedia is terrible because anybody can, you know, write anything on that. And it's therefore terrible. Well, there's a lot of powerful ways it can be used. And in this specific context, when you're going to need to check out a source, putting that source into Wikipedia, seeing what people have said about it, what kind of debate is happening on the talk page. I mean, anyway, though, I wonder if we could have something where the Choose Your Own Adventure, there's a YouTube path, there's a Google path, maybe there's a Wikipedia path, because getting people into those tools and doing live searches and comparing differences and things like that, that seems to me to be a pretty good idea for engagement. Joyce Valenza, the keynote of this summer's Digital Institute of Media Literacy, says it's also understanding the source type ecosystem. And she gives us a resource. Isn't it time to stop the Wikipedia shaming? Joyce, I love you. Do you know this? That's fantastic. Because I do think we are in a lot of classes trying to just stop kids from using the web in some cases, but, you know, using Wikipedia specifically. Yeah, that's, what are your thoughts on Wikipedia? Do you think that could be something that would fit into this for the future?
It would be, my only concern with Wikipedia, only for the audience of the group that we're trying to teach for, the middle school one. I mean, I'm just wondering if it might be too text dense. That would be like my only, yeah. Like I would say, like, I think if we did Google, YouTube initially and seeing if like that might be, and I'm not saying that they couldn't do it. I'm just wondering in terms of like what the order of those things could be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, one of my lessons learned, yes, Kristen says we all love Joyce. We do. The project I came up with last year, and I mean, this was my first year to teach middle school, outside of a Sunday school class, which is very different. I mean, we kind of created a graduate level activity that was just way beyond what was reasonable in terms of media literacy and for fifth and sixth grade. I mean, I'd like to do something that could certainly be scaled and done at different levels, but I don't, we're talking about a workshop. We're talking about, you know, like maybe a 45 minute session. Maybe it could be a little bit longer, but I think even just what we were talking about now about YouTube and Google and looking at the search differences, and, you know, we can have some resources as well as far as like an introductory video into this, then choose your own adventure about what path you'd like to do. If people have time, they could document some of that, and then you could have kind of a wrap-up video that compares some of that too. So
I would kind of go back to something that Joyce had said about ecosystem too, is, I mean, this is something that I've had to chase several friends in things that they've posted online, which is like, how is it that you keep on posting Plandemic, or that you've posted a video that was originally posted in February, but is posted yesterday about the dubious nature of wearing masks, you know, with, well, so like that can't be that was posted 2 days ago, but the original video was from February. And certainly we've learned more about the transmission of COVID since February, but yet that was such a bad faith application of that video that was just re-released yesterday. So, I mean, that had everything to do with the ecosystem by which my friend was using this, that they didn't realize that they were, you know, like Roach Motel bringing this piece back for everyone else to consume, when that was not, and I had confronted my friend. I said, you know, you realize what just happened here. You need to take this down. I mean, this is a bad faith argument that you are trying to blend everything up in people's mind. But that's, unfortunately, that seems to be, the ecosystem, I think, is a very important element of that. And then I'm hoping that the type of, almost like ethical standards that what we come up with in this will at least begin to be the initial seeds of saying, look, if the source is doing X, Y, and Z, and if they're falling outside of this, then, you know, it's time to check your wallet. Like this is not something that now you have to be even that much, your hackles should be up, your antenna on full blast from this. And so I think the more that we give those types of, and it doesn't mean that those sources aren't looking good to disguise themselves, right? So, I mean, like certainly, like if you were to put CNN up next to RT, you know, RT is doing a lot of things to legitimize itself aesthetically, on many fronts. And yet, you know, what does it matter that we're getting these bits of information from a foreign country's propaganda, outreach?
I mean, they had Brian May from Queen on for a special interview. Right. It's got to be great, right? Okay. So Kristen asked if we wanted to get our eighth graders' opinion on that. Yeah, absolutely, Kristen. I just direct message you on Twitter the join link for our StreamYard. So if you and her and she would like to join, please do. Joyce is saying kids don't understand the news cycle. I think that is so true. So many opportunities to rethink the way we teach. I mean, as an adult, I will admit that I have just not been as attuned to, like, the Wall Street Journal has a predominant bias. CNN has a predominant bias. Russia Today has a specific agenda as basically a propaganda arm of the Russian government. And it hasn't been that long ago that I have become more aware of that as myself, right? And I am teacher, citizen, dad, all these kind of things. So somebody pointed out, and I don't know if we talked about this last time, just how important it is for kids to know about op-eds. You know, I mean, op-eds are different than news. This is somebody's opinion. So I don't know. I think that one of the challenges for this whole project and what we've talked about is there's so much, right? Because it's a complex information landscape. There's a lot of different inputs. And so kind of just breaking it down to something digestible. I think that's why we've kind of centered on the moon landing as a topic, that it is something which we are probably going to have less controversy for today as far as people getting mad that we're talking about that. But the extrapolation that you can do from that into these different arenas, you know, depending on your context and situation, I mean, this is current events as well. So I think there's an elegance to that, because we could be taking this historical event, which, by the way, we're very proud of, you know, in the United States, and there's all kinds of great actual things that have happened with the anniversary of Apollo and with the astronauts and NASA and all that stuff. Which, by the way, Brian, I don't know if you caught this. Our son's actually working to support the ISS now as an engineer. So he's not going to move down to Houston for a while. But anyway, the space program, there's all kinds of really positives around all of that. So I think there's an elegance, because even climate change, that's what we designed, my partner and I, last year at the Institute. We're going to tackle climate change. Well, very controversial. I mean, maybe it's not where you live, but where I live here in Oklahoma, like if you want to ask people to really dig into climate change in school, which I think we should, but that is a much more bigger ask for teachers than to say, let's look at the moon landing and conspiracy theory and that playbook. And let's look at the algorithms and platforms of our time now, Google and YouTube primarily. And let's take a look what happens when we do research here. Joyce is saying there's no such thing as neutral text. Journalists choose whom they interview, whose voices are not heard as a serious question. And Kristen is saying that she and Joyce argue with her son, who's now 20, and he says it's not news if it's biased. She says there's no news that doesn't have some level of bias. I mean, there's an agenda today that wants us to all give up on journalism. And I think that's an essential part of what we want to do, is help people maintain faith in truth and integrity and not become nihilists and just give up. That is Putin's agenda, right? He would really like us to be super divided as a nation, completely ineffective as a representative democracy, and more broadly, just kind of give up, as I think probably some people in Russia, maybe, I don't know how many people in that information ecosystem, that propaganda machine. So
yeah, I mean, it doesn't even have to even get that. I mean, of course, we could look at the various different channels, whether or not it comes from Russia, China, or North Korea, or Iran, or all these various different ways in which these wedges are occurring. But I think the tricky part is then, you know, you can kind of really. Have you ever read anything about Chomsky and Herman's manufacturing consent and the five filters of reality? You know, like you could even, I mean, there's such a broader thing about whether or not just the mere fact of who's advertising, and does that just naturally scare away certain topics that you want to go after anyway. So like it's even more complicated, you know, and we haven't, there's that whole angle as well. But I think for our purposes, for this, what I like about the moon landing is that it is something that is approachable. It will provide exactly the examples, and I think it will provide the type of architecture and standards by which we can then convey into the very next thing. So when we do in hopefully when someone does come across a text that seems dubious, if it is now things that as they get older and they come across something that is climate change or it is about the efficacy of vaccines or whatever it is, like they should be able to know what are the various different threads that are exposed on that sweater to be able to pull apart in terms of it being a dubious source. And so I think that's the hopefully that we will give enough a heuristic for the students that they'll remember when they engage. Cause I just don't see YouTube changing or Google changing anytime soon. And I think that we should be able to kind of catch that.
Jonas Hamilton says at the end of the day, it's not about pure absolute objectivity. It's about relative reliability. Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, a few other papers are far from perfect. They have a detectable editorial posture, but they also have a certain standard of corroboration, which requires cross-checking and confirmation of the stories they publish, which usually ensures some degree of credibility. And I think that's exactly right. I think that today our fractured media environment is putting greater burdens on us as both adults and as students and researchers, anybody using the web. It's because Walter Cronkite isn't on at 6 o'clock, right? And you don't just have these three channels. It is a much more fractured, I think you might use the word balkanized, you know, media landscape. And so the skills that we're bringing and the understanding we're bringing, that's going to look different, obviously, at elementary and middle and high school and post-high school levels. But I think that helping with tools and helping with, you know, so what I would love, it's what you just said, like as a result of doing some of these activities, it's like a new lens. You've got a different lens. And so when you see that, body image is an example too, right? This is part of why media literacy is so important. When you see a media message and it's crafted to help you be dissatisfied with the way you look, wants you to go buy a product, and maybe even just question yourself at a deep level with your identity. Like you're being manipulated and somebody's trying to hack you. We want, I think, folks of all, you know, stripes to be aware of that kind of thing. And so that would be a success in my mind for this workshop, is that if as a result of this, people are going to be a little more aware of, wait a minute, I've got to consider why I'm being fed that information, where that came from. I think all that's good. Joyce is saying the heuristics can be dangerous. She's saying it's at the article level. And Kristen is not going to be able to join us because of a hailstorm. Her power is out. That's okay. That's all right. I wonder, should we, on our Google Doc then kind of just sort of chart out a lesson plan for kind of what that can look like, in terms of, cause you're thinking introductory video and then give people some choices of some activities. Cause if we would design, how in the Institute, are they 45 minute sessions? What have they historically been?
All right. Yeah, 45 minutes. Yeah. Okay. 2 hours.
And for like 45 to 60 minutes. Something that's come about, which is exciting, actually before the Institute next week, I had put in this topic as a session for a Montana conference that is called the Mountain Moot, and it happens July 16th, 17th, and 18th. And they actually said, hey, we need a second keynote. Would you be willing to do that as a keynote? So I'm going to have a chance to share some more just like presentation discussion of these issues. But I'm thinking if we flesh out some more what this workshop would be like, I probably can get that added as a virtual workshop to the Mountain Moot. And then potentially we could end up doing that as part of the week with the Digital Literacy Institute as well. Cause I think this is the kind of thing you want to iterate with, and it's going to look different with obviously adults than it is going to be with students. But if we came up with a format, and maybe, you know, it's something that we actually have on a website or something like that, but it's an activity that's going to let people, you know, get some overview information, but have some choices, and then actually go out and use the web and compare accounts and results. How would be a good way to share those results back, especially if we think about students? I mean, not even all teachers are going to be on Twitter. So, I wonder if we would do like a Padlet or what, how you would want people to capture some of that. Like if they did the autofill, you know, screencast or something like that. That might be
something. Yeah. That would be, I'd have to think about it, like how that would be something that could be communally shared in a way in the event that they're not on Twitter or something like that. The
maybe just a Google form. Maybe people could just use a Google Drive, like
share the link
because we're
of what their screen capture was, or if it's, they make a quick video or they do it just a screen capture of what that may be. Yeah, you know, the other thing too is I always remember that someone was, it's not only that just it's the algorithm, but like, it would be interesting just to, and it would be, we couldn't like necessarily trap it in a real time sense, but what we could do is, with the dummy account that we make is then just let the auto suggest run, right? And then see how the material becomes more, loud and aggressive. And I always remember someone was making the case of saying something like, look, if I just wanted to go like do a couch to 5K, you know, how do you do that? And you put that on YouTube and then you let the auto, the auto suggest go. Then all of a sudden, like maybe five videos later, I'm doing an ultra marathon. Like, whoa, like what's happening here with that? Right. I think that could be an interesting, like, and it would be hard to like even, especially with our students, but I think we could say like, you know, look where we started off and how can you describe the language of what our initial search was and then how the fifth or sixth one auto suggest what seems to be the difference between what has happened here and just to see how that occurs. Because I think that would be another way to kind of demonstrate the stickiness of the algorithm and trying to keep people on the site, because that's what they want to have happen, which is to deliver you to the advertiser as often as possible.
We could do this through a Google form, document your breadcrumbs. How many clicks away are you from a real outlier video that is conspiracy theory that you can just identify? And so I like, you know, we use the term breadcrumbs with web pages to talk about you're diving into these different pages and the breadcrumbs like Hansel and Gretel through the forest, you know, help you get back to where you came from before. So finding out, like, because you could even do that with the same search, right? So we could start out with moon landing hoax, or maybe you don't even put the word hoax in. Maybe you just say Apollo moon landing. And then, you know, some of the documentation would be, one of the first videos that you clicked on, and basically using the recommended videos there on the side and seeing where different people go. Because this is kind of like with Facebook advertising during the election, the 2016 election, we didn't have a library of publicly shared political ads. So there were all these ads that were opaque to most folks, because if you weren't the target of those ads, you didn't see them. Similarly, I think this is I've been guilty of this too. Like with Google, you just kind of think, well, if I just send you to Google, I mean, it's true, depending on the search term, if it's for an organization, it's for a book, it's for an author, yeah, you're probably people are going to find the same thing. But when it comes to some of these topics and then the ways that people are gaming the algorithms and then in the extreme bad case, I think, you know, weaponizing them, I think that's an aha we want people to have, is that, you know, it's not a uniform experience to just say, well, just go to Google. I mean, you know, it's going to render different results depending on a variety of factors. And if we can help people become more savvy to the tools that they're using, then hopefully they'll be able to use them better and then be more critical consumers of the information that they.
Yeah. I mean, the one I think deficit is that, I was looking at what Jonas had written there, is for our students, and this might be, this just isn't necessarily where we are, where they are, is, and I don't know I don't know if the type of disinformation is as prevalent in Snapchat, for sure, I think you could see these things in Instagram. So it would be interesting just to know how that exists in that platform as well. I think that would be, because it is interesting to see how it manifests itself in those spaces where they might be a little bit more, a Google search and a YouTube, they're definitely there, but there is a whole other wing of that. It wouldn't be helpful for us to kind of say, well, look what's going on in Facebook, because that's not where our students are at, And I remember I had this, I think I sent this to you when it happened. This was a pre-COVID epiphany when with my freshmen, we were doing a unit on persuasion, and we were looking at similar kind of algorithm hacking, right? And so I had this thought, because a student of mine, she said, this is weird. Like, my phone is showing me to buy new Keds or something like that, like just brand new white Nikes, or maybe they're Keds or something like that. I was like, All right, everyone, take out your phone. If you have an Instagram, this is what I want you to do. I want you to go to a place where you had definitely checked in on Instagram. So you were at the aquarium, or you were at the Bean in Chicago, where you would just like go back, look at that picture, just like make sure you revisit that post and make that the only thing that you're looking at. So they did. And then when we refreshed and then go back to the top of the stream, then all of a sudden the algorithm's like, ooh, what is this? And so all of a sudden students are getting advertisements for baseball bats because they looked at camp that they were at. All of a sudden that it's like they woke up the slumbering giant of the algorithm. And then all of a sudden it's like, I know what you're looking at. And every student had this similar experience with that. And it was, every one of them was like, whoa, like that. It was, you could see they understood what was going on.
Right. Those are probably cookie tracking. My daughter told me a story this morning about having a FaceTime call, and the topic of their discussion then became an ad she saw on Instagram, 5 minutes later. So I think some of those kinds of things where, we can be that would be more for high school and for college, but with kids right. being able to use the platforms that they're on predominantly, and then becoming aware of, how did that happen? What algorithm is working here that suddenly I said this?
That's next year's session, Wes. That's next year. And so we'll do the algorithm jamming or something like that. That'll be more, I think more time to think about that. Well, so I think like with the conspiracy, idea, so if we're thinking about like how we'd set it up, it would be like, look, this is where we're at, in terms of why it's important that we give students the type of tools to be able to vet out good sources initially. I mean, and again, like it is next level. I mean, if to look at how things like RT or some of the other ones that do look aesthetically, with the studios, with the graphics, with all that stuff. Like, I mean, it upon first blush, of course, you would think this is a legit site. So, but that's not where our students would be if we're talking about middle schoolers and all of that. There was an activity that I did with my AP students a few years ago where I remember when I just so happened to be like in a I was in Chicago. It was like a date weekend with my wife, and I was flipping through the channels, and I didn't know what RT was. And this must've been 10 years ago. So I was flipping through the channels, and there was this, news piece. It was just silly. It was, cut her off. I'm trying to remember who the president of Chechnya is at the time. And, what had happened is that there was a game between Chechnya and Brazil, and they were playing soccer, and like it was on RT, and the president scored a goal or something like that. So I was like, I gotta find that, right? Because this is kind of like, this is, this you can't, but what you find is that this was like a 40-year-old Brazilian players, and they're brought in just for the whole pomp and circumstance of that. But what was interesting is that you have that RT piece. And then I found one that was done by Al Jazeera. And even though Al Jazeera is also its own version of a state information news wing as well, but what they were able to parse in language and contextualize about why Chechnya is doing it versus what was going on in RT was just two really interesting juxtapositions of journalism, what you can say and what you can't. Even though it was just about a soccer game, there was a lot going on between those two pieces. There's all about like 4 minutes each. I think I made an activity. I had a student assistant listen and type out the text of those things just so we could see both of those things next to each other. But that's the next level of that, right? So that's where you would have to, hopefully students could be able to recognize
there was a lot going on,
to look for.
It's all about like,
there you go. There's Kristen. Yeah, I think so. And I think that we can include sort of next level, like where you might take it for extension. So that might be a call out that if people have resources related to the moon landing and anything around critical thinking, it's not a hoax. One of the videos that I've put, I think, on the page so far, and I think maybe we can start a separate Google Doc for this lesson plan, basically. There's a fantastic video that was a few years old, but it's about how the technology to fake it wasn't available. You know, I mean, with green screen and smartphones and all this today, like it's incredible what we are now considering normal in terms of production capabilities. But I think that extensions to this, the other thought that I had is if talking about how people would share it, Kristen had suggested like maybe some Google Slides. If students wanted to make a short little narrated slideshow, you know, Adobe Spark Post is one of the tools that I taught my students last year. So they could do some screenshots of their breadcrumbs. Here's where my search went. I started with this, and then I went to here, and then I went to here. And so they could have those screenshots. They could talk over those. And I mean, I like the fact that that is such a specific media literacy thing that I don't know how much, and maybe kids are more savvy to this than I give them credit for, but, you know, our results are going to be different based upon our history that we've had with YouTube, and then other kinds of factors. So,
yeah, and I'll share this with you again. It was the project that I did with Kara and Julie, first semester a year or so ago. And one of the activities, and I have to find if I saved them. I hope I did, but one of the activities was I asked my students, and it was like, okay, what I'm going to ask you to do is do a screen capture video. I want you to, search, I can't remember what topic, what are you interested in? I gave them certain topics. I said, go ahead and search. And so they had to like, just, you know, this is what I do. This is what I search. Then I had them stop. I said, okay, now I want you, I'm trying to remember the order I did this in. I think this makes sense. And I said, how do you think someone who doesn't know what they're doing, how do you think they search? Now go do that. Like do it on purpose, like conspicuously do bad search. And then do the second one was like, okay, well, how do you think a smart person was? So now you have three different modes of reflection, right? Which is like, this is what I did. This is what I think about what a bad person does. And this is what I think a smart person does. And then have them kind of vend all of that together. And it was good, you know? And so I have to, like, I'm wondering if that could also be, we'd have to think about how that would be a trap, you know, where you would mine the breadcrumbs from that. But I thought that was something that was, I think, really powerful for them to think about. Because I could see the light bulb go off in their head, like, oh, yeah, that, like, I kind of did the bad search here, you know? So it was interesting.
I want to pipe in as a parent who comes from a media literacy perspective, right? I will never forget my child who struggled with all of the information coming in. Getting a project. I want to say it was like an eighth grade science. And I said to the teacher something along the lines of, they had a biome project to do. And I said to the teacher, like, do you have any breadcrumbs or do you have any like suggested ideas for searching for my child? Cause she gets overwhelmed. She didn't have an IEP, but she just was a kid who went all through the system. She did birth to three. And then by the time she got to school age, she didn't. And we still had to work with her very diligently. And she got overwhelmed with information. And the teacher said to me, I said, do you have any like pathfinders or any resources or things that could help my child to like navigate this landscape? And she said, well, if you just Google, and she gave me like three or four Google search terms. And I was like, dude, you're not hearing what I'm saying. Yeah. Like that Googling for my child is completely overwhelming and they don't understand that navigation. And so like, sometimes I have to take a step back and think like, when we talk about a good searcher or a bad searcher, like kids are so unaccustomed to like what that actually means. And especially at this age, I was trying to get my daughter had basketball and it's like the first time she's been out of the house in months. So like she was
standing her way.
She told me afterwards, she's like, I exercise today. Now I'm eating my food and I am taking a shower and I'm going to bed. Especially because she's the youngest and she's been the one that gets sucked into all this stuff with Renee. But I think it's fascinating because my kids have been in a place where from their earliest years, right, they have been sucked into like, what do you see? What does this mean? Whose story is it telling? What is missing? But I don't, and the thing that I was going to suggest for your session is reminding teachers that media literacy is a huge piece of the Common Core. So any states that are in education, if you're talking to classroom teachers, like that idea of media being another form of, like, I think of print, like print-based media is what everybody focuses on, right? Like we have to get kids to read because that's what it says. But really that print is just one form of media. And unless we're also focusing on the imagery that goes along with it and the video that goes along with it and whose story is being told and who's is missing, we're just rewriting our curriculum for the seventh grade. And we were really struggling with like, how do we end it? Because we're starting with like perspective and we're talking about media literacy and perspective. And we want to end it now with, okay, so can you really write a narrative from someone else's perspective and looking at like, what does that look like? So I'm super excited about it. But again, I think like we don't spend enough time talking about when you look at this thing, who's telling the story, right? Whose story is missing? How would the story change if that was there? And then from a kid perspective, like, how do you ensure that the truth or your truth, right? I mean, I think there's this idea around media and truth. I put something in the chat earlier, like my 20-year-old was like, well, it's not news if it's not true. I'm like, but true to who? Like, how do you define what truth is and how do you define, right? Like,
yeah. Let's touch on some postmodern thought, but let's not lose ourselves, really. Yeah.
No. And I think that's probably what we have to frame, which is, I don't think that I'm going to, with my students, and I don't think you're not going to say, guys, let's go to Google, let's go to YouTube and see what we get, right? So we're going to, by our original position is going to say, we're going to use what our school databases have vetted for us, which is the best scholarly material that our school has paid for via these subscriptions. Like I've always made that the funnel by which I demand my students to go there first, always. So once we establish like, okay, when life happens and you're just grazing on the internet and you come across these things, now that's different. You're not a student trying to find the best material about the cotton gin or any of these other things. Now you're just, oh, what's this? Now you're a different persona. The mask is not as student. The mask is you as like who you are right now. Now this is the most important part of propaganda is that you're more exposed. I'm intrinsically curious to know more about this particular topic. And that's where they get. So I think that might be something that we, maybe kind of make a distinction like that, Wes, which is, you know, we know we're going to chase you away from conspiracy things early on in the research vetting process. That wouldn't happen when we're doing this in school. We would make that an obvious teachable moment and move on. But we're not with you 24 hours a day. And we know that you're going to, as Joyce had said before, we're not, the school database is not the ecosystem, the information ecosystem where they are most. So, how can we return them into the wild with the particular tools to be able to make it out of the swamp? And I think that's what I think is essential.
Well, and I think sprinkle on it that we will have scholars from Chicago Public. We'll have scholars from Philadelphia Public Schools, from Charlotte, like places that don't necessarily have the means to fund those vetted databases and resources for their students. And so, like, we're looking at some of these systems who a librarian or media specialist is not a necessary in their school system. And so how do you help teachers to do that job as well? I think that's something that's going to be critical as we start to talk about this, right? Because I remember Joyce in my early years would say, laptops have legs. Right. So like, just because you have a laptop in your classroom doesn't mean you can't take your laptop to the library to do that research or to talk to the librarian or to think about like what those tools are. But if there's no librarian there, if there's no media specialist, if there's not someone who is specialized in this concept of misinformation and, like good research strategies, like how do you ensure that that happens for all students, right, in your schools? And I think that's a huge challenge, especially in the middle grades, right? Because in the elementary schools, they might do it for book selection. In the high schools, they might do it because we're trying to get kids ready for college. But in the middle grades, there's no guarantee that you're going to have that person who's specialized in that. Now, you guys have a background. I have a background. Like, we're going to ensure that it happens in our school and in our system, but I don't know that that's necessarily across the board.
And that's probably just going to be an equity issue that we can't, you know, probably, remedy in the session, you know, but like, I think that the, hopefully the, again, the type of framing that we will be able to arrive at will be ones that just will just chase away, chase away the falling down the rabbit hole. And I think that's what's key.
I think the focus on YouTube is really good. I mean, it continues to be the number two most popular search engine in the world. It's an incredibly powerful platform that, you know, has a lot of good, but it also has some stuff that's, you know, been used for a lot of malicious purposes. And we're seeing responses with the tech companies to, you know, pressures and things like that. But I think I feel good about having a bit of a more solid focus. We had a topic last time. Now we're drilling down. But like, I also, from last summer, I don't want to go down that road of like, hey, I just made a doctoral level activity that, you know, I'm never going to be able to do with, you know, fifth and sixth grade. So I think we've got some solid ideas here. I want to give voice to a couple comments that Jonas had, and maybe we can get a couple closing comments and we can wrap it up. Jonas asks if there's a diagnostic test to help students and teachers measure their level of Google searching fluency or sophistication. That is a great question. I know when I participated in the Google Teacher Academy back in 2005, and that was earlier days than what they do now with certifications and things. We hung out at the Boulder Google office for a whole day. Like everything Google that have been a part of, like, of course, search is a key part of it. And so I'm not aware of something like that. Kristen, are you aware of something like that? That is, his second follow-up asked, he says there could be value in getting students to create a verbal record of their process while searching, a protocol along the lines of what De Groot did with chess players, analyzing differences between a master's thinking process versus that of weaker players. And I think that's what you were talking about, Brian, with your search activity was like, here's how I would just do it now, but I'm going to put on these separate lenses and I'm going to really be savvy. And then I'm going to also be, you know, not as informed.
So I think some of the tools, like I know all size is one for like looking at different sides of an argument. So like if you're looking through this lens or if your search terms in whatever turned you up as being left-leaning or right-leaning from a political perspective, that might be one way to look at it. And then to reflect to say, here's why I want to look at this source. Here's why I want to look at this source. Here's how the two sources come together. Like, I think that would be a valuable activity for kids to start to see some of that idea of bias. But I agree, like, one of the things I am finding being now an administrator, right, in education is like that reflective piece. Like, I want anybody that I interview for a teaching position or an admin position to talk about the importance of reflection in learning, right? Because really, you can't learn something unless you reflect on the pros, the cons, the mistakes, and the value that you got from that whole process. And I think the same thing is with media literacy. And my kids hate me for it, right? But like from the very earliest ages, like Renee Hobbs was always so impressed when she would talk to my kids because they could talk about like at 3 years old, well, this person is mean because on like a kid's TV show. I don't think that there's enough of that. And again, I go back to our standards demand it now with media literacy in the Common Core that we're not, because we're so focused on print-based media and getting kids to read and to be able to spit back what they read from a comprehension perspective as opposed to a deeper analytical perspective, we're really doing kids a disservice, right? And that whole idea of media, whether it's in the form of a meme or a political ad or a commercial or a whatever, or a conspiracy theory, right? To be able to dig in and really say, like, whose story is being told? Whose story is, you know, it's the media literacy remote, right? What's being left out? And how do we ensure that we include that so we have more of a whole picture?
Yeah. Jonas is apologizing for all over the place comments. Jonas, keep the questions coming. I'm thrilled to hear. And by the way, today in this Media Literacy Club meeting, we're talking about authentic audience and student writing. I think I'm going to try to get my sixth graders blogging this year. And I know we've talked about that with some different history faculty. Great, great conversations around the ways in which we're not only equipping and empowering students to be more savvy consumers and researchers and finders of information, but the ways in which they're sharing that and the ways that they're connecting with an audience and all that kind of stuff. So I want to invite everybody to like have a closing thought of whatever you would like to share. And then I think we probably better actually wrap that up. My daughter was just in here like, Dad, when are you going to be off your computer? So Brian, closing thoughts about maybe next steps or just kind of where this conversation tonight's taking you.
Yeah. So I think the next step is, you know, I'm going to go through because I think there's some parts we may not have to necessarily reinvent the wheel. I'm going to go back and I'll send you some of the things that I did with that project. Cause I think I did a lot of, screen capture of like, hey, look what happens when I look at this, when I type in global warming, what pops up in that. So I know I made those videos to show the difference between what any of those things look like, with that. So, I think I'm going to look at that and, you know, I just think that and maybe I think I'll start trying to find various different degrees of, okay, so this is a moon landing source. This is what, you know, and again, kind of like a Goldilocks approach, like this one, and then finally get the one that's off the rails. And I think each one of those could then serve as the choose your own adventure branch as we kind of head through that. So I'll start searching some of that.
Sounds good. Kristen, your thoughts?
StreamYard.
Oh, you hadn't seen this before?
No. Having a chance to chat with the two of you.
Yeah.
Also, if you guys have not gotten into Pathright for building for the Summer Institute, Frank Ramon and I. Yeah. So we have a really super cool, awesome tool for the Summer Institute that I would love to share with you in terms of like building this idea and content, because I feel like this is something that could even blow beyond the Summer Institute. So I know you guys are working on a workshop. I don't know if anybody's reached out to you. I know our leadership team for Summer Institute is totally overwhelmed. I'm totally overwhelmed in my job and not like having a week to go to Chicago and actually do.
Right. But
Frank and I are meeting on Wednesday. I'd love to chit chat with you guys about that because I think I see a lot of potential for not only this workshop, but also this conversation to continue beyond this from a lab perspective. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Wes, I have your number. I'll be hooking you up. You
can good. That sounds good. Well, for everybody, we want to let you know that you can access this collection of resources, medialiteracy.westfriar.com, link at the top for conspiracies and culture wars. There's a Google Doc there that we're going to keep adding to. We'll take this audio again and make this as a podcast, share that out, and follow that hashtag, the hashtag ConCW. Nobody had tweeted to that since 2014, so I was like, I think that looks pretty safe. You never know what's going to happen with a hashtag, but the benefit of using that is as you find a resource, if you've got something that relates to this conversation, you want to be a part of the conversation, it's a hashtag that I've got some eyes on. And this is part of the incredible power, positive power of the tools that we have, right? Because we can be geographically distributed here. We got Oklahoma City, Chicago, Pennsylvania. We got folks all over the place that really do care about media literacy and these kinds of issues. And so helping not only equip our students, which is obviously the focus of what we do in school is help our students to learn, but the stakes of this conversation are really, really big. And I think this goes to the idea of civics and citizenship and responsibilities. And Tristan Harris said it in the Center for Humane Technologies podcast. It's called Your Undivided Attention. He said, we assume for our political system that people have sovereign minds and the ability to be able to discern facts and be able to form opinions and not to just be manipulated by disinformation. Like, we're living in times that are very, very challenging, and we've got responsibilities as educators that we want to step up for. So thanks to Jonas. Thanks to Kristen. Thanks to Joyce Valenza for joining us. I haven't seen Joyce in years. I wish we were going to be together. Don't you wish we're going to be together in person? But anyway.
I do.
But hey, it is what it is. And if we can be safe and avoid, you know, contracting a pandemic disease and sharing that with our families, then that's a positive. So, all right. Well, let's do this closing. Where can people find you online, Brian?
You can find me at Twitter at WeGoTwits, but you know that's where you just tweet at me, and I can follow up with any questions. I usually just kind of tweet silly stuff. So,
and Kristen, in addition, we've got your Twitter handle up on the screen. Where else are you sharing these days?
Oh Lord, that's pretty much about it. I mean, Facebook, Instagram. I'm Kristen Hokanson on both. K Hokanson on Twitter. My focus these days is on inquiry-based teaching and learning, but a lot of these pieces are falling right in line with why is it important for us to get kids asking questions and questioning the things that they see and read and hear about. So,
yep, absolutely. So I am W. Fryer on Twitter, and we'll continue the conversation. Thank you all so much for joining. And yeah, StreamYard, Jason Neifer and I have been using this for, I don't know, 6 or more months, ever since YouTube Hangouts or Google Hangouts discontinued the live Hangouts on air. We had to find something else. And this is a great platform. I know some folks who are using this for their school board meetings too, because the channel thing of live to YouTube and Facebook. And once you get the channel.
My brain is, I'm now in charge of all our school board meetings, and we're working on ideas for what happens in September if we don't come back. So.
Yeah. So, well, Sand Springs ISD in Oklahoma, their tech director had put out a call like, what are you guys doing for live board meetings and all this? And live, you know, anyway, I'd shared that and they're using that. But it's a fantastic platform. It also keeps a digital copy for like 7 days of what you end up sharing. But there's free. Anyway, I think I pay like 20 a month or something to like, it takes the branding off and then you can do more simultaneous channels. But I want to be paying. There's things that are good to pay for, right? Because if we're not paying, we are the product. We know.
Yeah, that. Absolutely. That's the data. You're paying in, you're paying in your information and data. So.
Yeah. And also, if they don't find a way to monetize, they're not going to stay around. And I just love this platform. I think it's been great. So Brian, do we want to maybe connect again next week? Is Monday night good, or should we, or we can just touch base and find another, because I feel like if we did one more touch before the Institute, that might be good to kind of see where
Sure. We can probably do Monday again. I can't think of anything off the top of my head where that would be an issue. So
sure. Yeah. Why don't we try for Monday at 7 again, and if anybody else wants to join us, we'll be here.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you, everybody.